All right, 25th part, 25th lesson in Genesis this evening. And starting in chapter 22, we covered most of chapter 22 last week, but we have a few verses left. And the last few verses, although not terribly exciting, do have a bit of importance to them. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in the Bible, would they? So, if you remember, last week was, of course, in chapter 22, where Abraham takes Isaac and he is told to sacrifice him, but is stopped short. And so that brings you up to date as to what happened in chapter 22. So, after that event with Isaac, and they return home. Abraham receives news from his original home, the land of Ur, the Chaldees, where he was originally from. You know, we all have a place where we originated from, and you know, we can say, well, you know, maybe it was Kentucky or you know, Georgia, or you know, I'm from California, somewhere you call home. Well, you know, that's where he was from, was Ur of the Chaldees, and he got news from that place. And it was about his brother, Nahor, and that he was the father of many children. He had not received any news about his brother Nahor, and that's his only, if you remember, he had two brothers, and that's his only surviving brother. And if you remember in Genesis 11, starting in verse 27, we have the generations of Terah, Terah being the father of Abraham. Terah begat Abraham, Nahor, and Haran, and Haran begat Lot, but Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. That's, of course, where they were all born. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and the father of Iscah. And of course, Sarah was barren and she had no children. And then when they left the land of Ur of the Chaldees, just to remind you of what happened back then, verse 31, Terah took Abram, his son. So Abram went with Terah, his father, and Lot, which would have been his nephew, the son of Haran, who died, Abram's brother, and Sarah, his daughter-in-law, that's Abram's wife, and they went forth from Ur of the Chaldees to go to the land of Canaan. Well, that left, of course, Nahor and his wife, Milcah, in Ur of the Chaldees. So those two did not go along with the rest of the family to the land of Canaan. Well, so you have this announcement, this news that comes along. And what it is in Genesis chapter 22, verses 20 through 24, and it came to pass after these things, well, of course, after these things was the whole event with Isaac and whatnot, that it was told Abraham, saying, behold, Milcah, well, Milcah being the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, Milcah, she hath also borne children unto thy brother Nahor, Huz, his firstborn, and Buz, his brother, and Kemuel, the father of Amran, and Chesed, and Hazo, and Pildash, and Jidlath, and Bethuel. And Bethuel begat Rebekah. These eight Milcah did bear to Nahor, Abraham's brother, and his concubine. So there was a concubine also to his brother, whose name was Ruma. She bare also Teba and Gaham and Thahash and Maacah. Now none of those from the concubine have any bearing on pretty much anything at all. Only one name in there, the last one. Mica shows up later in the Bible, but there's no, it's not the same one. So, but what's the significance? I don't know what's happening to the sound. It's me, the way I'm talking, probably. what is the significance of these verses here? Well, there's a number of different things that are significant. The biggest significance immediate that comes to mind, of course, is the birth of Rebekah. That from Abraham's brother and his wife, and from one of their children, Bethuel. So that would be, Bethuel is Abraham's nephew, and Bethuel begat Rebekah. So Rebekah is going to show up again, in the very next chapter. Not the next chapter, chapter 23, but in chapter 24. So, at any rate, there's one of the biggest significances there. But there is more significance than just that, as God often makes these announcements in just at the right time. So, God is with the birth of Rebekah, taking care of a need before the need even arises. And the announcement is being made at a kind of a strange time. Abraham's faith gets tested and tested and tested. It just got what I call the ultimate test when God says, take your son, your only son, and get him up on the mountain and sacrifice him to me. And Abraham was fixing to carry that act out when he was stopped. Well, this news is also going to be a little bit of a test of Abraham's faith too, because one of the issues with Abraham has always been his attraction to family, that he has always been very loyal to his family. So, this here, it just out of the blue comes news of his brother and his brother's wife and all the children and everything, and it comes at a strange time, because in Genesis chapter 23, the first event that happens is Sarah, his wife, dies. In Genesis 23, 1 and 2, and Sarah was 107 and 20 years old. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died in Kirjatharba. The name is Hebron in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Of significance, Sarah is the only woman in the Bible that we know the age of when she died, which is pretty unusual. And when you think about it, the death of Sarah must have been untimely for a number of different reasons. First of all, Abraham was not at home. It says right here that he came to mourn and to weep for her, so he was not present when she died. So obviously it was unexpected. You think about Sarah, and her beauty was such that at 99 years old, she was one that, or at 90 years old, she was one that the king wanted to take for his own. So she was a pretty good looking woman, apparently. And, so it's not a far stretch to say that even at 127, she's probably still a pretty good-looking woman, and her death was probably not expected and rather untimely. But meanwhile, obviously the response of Abraham is an appropriate response and shows the love that he had for Sarah. He comes and mourns and weeps and the death of a loved lost one, as we see in John 11:35, when Lazarus dies, the Jews comment that, you know, this is a man that Jesus obviously loved, because we have the shortest verse in the Bible: Jesus wept. And that at the death of Lazarus, the one who Jesus loved so much. So, even though Abraham is obviously distraught and saddened by the death of Sarah, God had made preparation in Abraham's life for her death and his willingness to sacrifice Isaac. I mean, you think about when Abraham was on his way with Isaac, and one of the lessons that we learned about the faith of Abraham was, you know, when he left the other two that had accompanied them to the base of the mountain, and says, "We will both be back." And he trusted God that he would raise up Isaac again, as it said in Hebrews 11:19, that even if he did sacrifice Isaac to God, he accounted that God was able to raise him up even from the dead. And so, you know, when we lose a loved one who is a believer, it's sad to see them go and leave our lives and leave our earthly experience. Yet the reality of it is that we can place our faith in God and understand that the promise of God is that He is able to raise them up again, and we trust Him to do exactly that. So that same faith that Abraham had, we also place in Abraham in the same situation, in the same circumstances, when one of our loved ones also passes. So then that's all that's said about Sarah's death. Two small verses. The rest of the chapter, on the surface, seems rather odd. When you first read this chapter, when I first read this chapter, I thought, what a strange chapter in the Bible this is. And I really had to think very long and hard about the lesson that this particular chapter in Genesis was trying to teach. You know, it's easy to understand about the death of someone and the death of Sarah in Abraham's life and the loss that it causes and the feelings of grief and the faith that we place in God to raise the believer back up again and all those things. It's easy to talk about those things and easy to teach about those things. But when you read chapter 23 in the book of Genesis, here Genesis chapter 23 is 20 verses long. 18 of those verses have nothing really to do with the death of Sarah, other than the arrangements for burial. And so, when you read it at first glance, it seems to be a very strange chapter, and you have to think, what is it that God is trying to teach here and to show as a lesson concerning Abraham that we should learn? And really the main issue is about a burial plot. I think about my family, and although those of you who are out of the area and online and out of state wouldn't recognize the name, here in Dayton we have a cemetery. It's called Woodland Cemetery. And very famous people, like the Wright brothers are buried there, and Irma Bombeck, the author, is buried there, and lots of very famous people are buried there, and lots of people who aren't famous are buried there. But it's other than the VA cemetery, I don't know if it's bigger or not, but it's probably one of Dayton's largest cemeteries, and without a doubt, it's the most beautiful cemetery. It goes up and down hills, and it's quite beautiful. But it is what it is. It's a cemetery. But for years and years, my family, and I mean years, from a long time before I was born, back in the middle 1800s, one of my ancestors bought a cemetery plot in Woodland Cemetery that was quite large and big enough to accommodate a lot of burials. And so there's a family plot there that there's a lot of moomaws buried in Woodland Cemetery, and they're all in the same family plot. And chances are that when I die, that's probably where I'll be buried, or it doesn't really matter to me where I'm buried. But you can do with me what you want, throw me in the ditch for all I care. I thought about that when I read about this with Abraham, and how really about 200 years ago, someone that I didn't know, his name was John Mumon, purchased a plot of land, and probably for a fairly goodly sum at the time. I have no idea what he paid, but probably a pretty good amount of money at the time, because I know what it would cost to. There's additional land adjacent, and land in that cemetery is very hard to purchase, but it's very expensive. And 200 years ago, someone that I didn't even know purchased land, and for 200 years, that piece of land has been used by his descendants to bury people who have died. And he knew that he wouldn't be the only one to be buried there. And when he died, his wife was buried there, he was buried there, his children were buried there. But he knew he didn't have enough children to take up all that plot. It was a pretty large plot. And so he knew that there would be many descendants and other Mumons that would be also buried there. Well, so is the case with the decision that Abraham has to make at this time. Where does he want to have a family burial plot? Because it really is kind of an important decision, because when somebody purchases something like that, it's a decision that you're not just making for yourself, but for many future generations. And Abraham was now in the position that he had to decide whether to bury Sarah, to purchase land, to purchase a sepulcher in the land of Canaan where they resided, or to take her back to the land of Ur, which is really their homeland, and bury her there. And the issue really was clouded and suddenly kind of confused by the sudden news that came about his brother. He hadn't heard about his brother for years and years, decades, since he had left. And suddenly here's this news out of the blue. Well, your brother's alive, he's got a wife, you know, he's still married, and he's got all these kids and now grandchildren. and he's, you know, doing wonderfully and everything. And Abraham could have said, you know what, it sure would be nice to go back there and see him and live out my life there with my brother and all that in the company of family. And I could take Sarah back there and bury her in the land of our nativity. And so he had a decision to make. But rather than do that, he was truly compelled to purchase a burial plot in the land that was promised to him by God. That was the other alternative that he had. Obviously, in Genesis 15:18, God had made a covenant with Abraham, saying, "Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Cananites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Rephaims and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Girgashites and the Jebusites." Now, in your outline, I underlined two of those, because two of those in particular are going to be affected in what happens in these. Yeah, it's all the ites again here, right? But two of those in particular are going to be affected in what happens in the rest of this chapter, and that is the Hittites and the Canaanites. And you remember the final expansion of the covenant that God gives to Abraham is that, remember, that Abraham would possess the gates of his enemies. Possess the gates of his enemies. And you see all these ites here, eventually they become the enemies of the Israeli people, of the seed of Abraham. And it's amazing what happens here. The possessing of the gates of the enemies of the descendants of Abraham. But Abraham approaches the Philistines in the land where he now resides, and that's the Canaanites. They live in the land of Canaan, to purchase a burial cave. So in verse 3, if you take a look, Abraham stood up from before his dead and spake unto the sons of Heth, saying, "I am a stranger and a sojourner with you. Give me a possession of a burying place with you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight." Remember the sons of Heth. He had been told that he could live, pick a place and live wherever he wanted in the land of the Philistines. Remember that. And so that's exactly what he did. But he didn't own any land. He just basically pitched a tent. But now he's saying, "I want a place to bury my dead." Well, it's foreign to us, the concept, but back then legal matters were conducted in public. Cities had gates to them. If you remember Sodom, and Lot was one of the elders in the city of Sodom, and he was at the city gate when the men came, the two angels. Well, business was conducted, legal matters were conducted at the city gate, and so it was in public, and that's where the elders would gather. Look in Ruth chapter 4, verse 1 through 3, when Boaz went up to the gate and sat him down there, and beheld the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by, unto whom he said, "Ho, such a one, turn aside, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit ye down here." And they sat down. And he said unto the kinsman Naomi, that has come out of the country of Moab, "Sell a parcel of land," which was our brother Amalek's. So here's a land deal going to be done. Well, much the same with Abraham. He's wanting to also get the rights to use a piece of land, a cave, as it were. Well, the Canaanites, they've been letting Abraham live on the land for free and pick wherever he wanted to live. Well, they volunteer any burial sepulcher to Abraham for his use and for free. Just go ahead and pick one and use it. Anybody, you know, anybody will let you use their burial sepulcher. You know, we love you. And because as Abimelech, you know, the king who had taken Sarah, and then, you know, God had given him the dream and said, you know, don't touch her, give her back to Abraham. You know, just as Abimelech recognized that God was with Abraham, these people did too. And in verse 5, the children of Heth answered Abraham, saying unto him, hear us, my Lord, thou art a mighty prince among us. In the choice of our sepulchres, bury thy dead. None of us shall withhold from thee his sepulchre, but that thou may bury thy dead. I mean, they would have gladly said, here, pick my sepulchre to bury your dead. You know, it'd be a blessing to me if you buried your dead wife in my sepulchre. Yeah, they understood, you know, anyone who blesses Abraham is going to be blessed. So, you know, that's exactly what they were doing. Well, there would have been nothing wrong with that. And the Lord was buried in a borrowed sepulchre, was he not? Matthew 27:59-60. When Joseph of Arimathea had taken the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and laid it in his own tomb, which he had hewn out of the rock, and he rolled a great stone in the door of the sepulchre and departed. You know, but the fact of the matter is, Abraham wanted this to be a permanent possession. He had made up his mind. He had two choices: either go back to Ur of the Chaldees to live with his brother, or rest on the promise of God. God said, I'm going to give you this land, and I'm either going to be a sojourner and a stranger here, or I want something permanent that is mine. And this was the time to make his mind. And so he said, I want something permanent here. And the sepulcher is what I want, to say this is Abraham's sepulcher. This is the burial plot. Well, so they offer him any sepulcher. Just pick one and use it. Well, Abraham's intention, he hadn't made his full intentions clear yet, obviously. In verse 7 through 9, Abraham stood up and bowed himself to the people of the land, even to the children of Heth, you know, showing utmost respect, bowed himself. And he communed with them, saying, if it be your mind that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and entreat me to Ephron, the son of Zohar. You see, Abraham already knew exactly what sepulcher he wanted. He knew. Entreat me to Ephron, the son of Zohar, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he hath, which is in the end of his field, for as much money as it is worth, he shall give it me for a possession of a burying place amongst you. So he knew who it belonged. He knew the field. He knew there was a sepulcher at the end of the field. He knew who it belonged to. And he says, I'll buy it. So, all Abraham's asking for is the cave, the sepulcher, at the end of the field. Well, and Ephron, he sees while I am not going to impugn Ephron, he's one of the sons of Heth, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But really, it's pretty easy to see that what he saw was, I can sell this field and get a good price. Sort of like the funeral homes. you know, where you like Tobias or whatever funeral home is in your particular area. You know, if you haven't made arrangements for all the things that go on with, when someone dies, the service and this, that, and the other thing, the casket and the burial and the taken to the cemetery and all the whatever happens. If you haven't made those arrangements prior, when someone dies, boy, they got you over a barrel. I mean, they got you over a barrel because you're not there to dick or price. You're just there to get the body buried. And they know that you are in a state of bereavement. And you're in no emotional condition. You know, it's not like when you go buy a car and you're looking for a haggling match with the car salesman. You're not there to dick or price with the guy at the funeral home. And they know that. Whatever price they shoot out there is the price that you're in. That's fine. And that's why they charge outrageous money. Well, Ephron probably knew that. And so he's seeing dollar signs. He's thinking, oh, this is wonderful. His wife just died. He doesn't have a place to bury her. And he wants to buy one. He wants to buy a place. I've got this place, and I've got this field that's attached to it, and he's already mentioned the field, and I would like to get rid of it too. And I can get good money for it. Well, in verses 10 and 11, Ephron dwelt among the children of Heth. And Ephron the Hittite answered. So here's the Hittites. Remember the promise of God in Genesis 15, verse 20? Part of that is the Hittites. You're going to take the land from the Hittites and from the Canaanites. Well, here's a Hittite who is dwelling in the land of the Canaanites. So, Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham and the audience of the children of Heth, even of all that went in the gate of his city, saying, "Nay, my lord, hear me. I wouldn't dream of selling it to you. The field give I thee." He's going to be magnanimous about it. "The field give I thee, and the cave that is therein. I give it thee in the presence of the son of my people. Give I thee, bury thy dead. I'll give you the cave and the field. Go ahead and bury your wife there." Well, of course, that's a calculated risk. Abraham could have said, "Why, thank you very much. I'll take you up on that offer and I'll just take the cave and the field. Appreciate it very much." But why did Ephron know that he would say no? Because he'd already said no. The children of Heth had already said, "Pick any sepulcher from anywhere among any of us for free and bury your dead." And he says, "No. I want to buy one." And Ephron knew that. So he says, "I'll tell you what, I'll give you the sepulcher and the field." So he enlarges the deal. He attaches the field to the sepulcher. Well, Abraham refuses the gift, but he accepts the alterations in the terms. In other words, he doesn't say, "Yeah, I bet he's a scam artist." Well, in a way, but notice who brought up the field first, Betty. It was Abraham that brought up the field first. It was Abraham. Because in verse 9, Abraham says, at the end of the field, there's a cave at the end of the field. Yeah. So Abraham all along had in mind, I want to get the field too. And, you know, it's a sort of subtle suggestion. I want to get the field too. Well, at the end of that field, there's a cave down there. At the end of that field. And so Abram says, I'll tell you what. We'll throw the field in on the deal. You can have them both for free. Well, so Abraham, verse 12, bowed himself down before all the people of the land. And he spake unto Ephron in the audience of the people of the land, saying, But if thou wilt give it, I pray thee, hear me. I will give thee money for the field. Take it of me, and I will bury my dead there. And Ephron is saying, Oh, this is great. This is great. Now comes the negotiations. And I am going to... And Ephron, he's just like the funeral home director. He's saying, there's not even going to be a negotiation here because I'm going to set the price that he can't negotiate. And how does he do that? Ephron answered Abraham, saying unto him, Oh, my Lord, hearken unto me. Well, this is what it's worth. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver, but... What's that between friends? In other words, between you and me, if you never gave me the 400 shekels of silver, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. We would still be friends. I wouldn't hold that against you. Nothing would change between us. But that's really what the land's worth, is 400 shekels of silver. Which is a highly inflated price, just like the funeral directors do. It says, but what is that betwixt me and thee? Bury therefore thy dead. In other words, it's worth 400 shekels of silver, but don't let that get in your way. Go ahead and bury your dead there, even if you can't pay it. So it doesn't leave Abraham any room for negotiation whatsoever. You know, Abraham can't come back and say, Well, I know you think it's worth 400, but I'll tell you what, I'll give you 300 for it. You know, he's already offered just to give it to him. And he's still offering to give it to him. He says, Well, it's worth $400, you know, 400 shekels. But don't worry about it. If you don't have the 400 shekels, just go ahead and, just bury your dead there for, you know, whatever. Don't worry about the 400 shekels. So there's no negotiating room in the price. It's brilliant. Well, Abraham's determined to purchase a stake in the land promised to him by God. He's determined to have skin in the game, as the saying goes. Have skin in the game. And when it comes to our Christian life, we've got skin in the game. We've been crucified with Christ. We've been buried with Christ. We're risen with Christ. You know, all these things. How does Abraham have skin in the game? Well, he purchases land according to the promise of God. So Abraham hearkened unto Ephron. And Abraham weighed Ephron the silver, which he had named in the audience of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, current money with the merchant. And the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field and the cave which was therein, and all the trees that were in the field, that were in all the borders round about, were made sure unto Abraham for a possession in the presence of the children of Heth before all that went in at the gate of the city. So everybody witnessed it, and everybody saw the exchange of money, and everybody knew then that it was Abraham's. The only thing left to do then is bury Sarah. And so Sarah is buried in the promised land, the field being a possession for Abraham and his children. Verses 19 and 20, after this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the field of the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre. The same is Hebron in the land of Canaan. And the field and the cave that is therein were made sure unto Abraham for a possession of the burying place by the sons of Heth. So what do we learn from all this? Well, there's quite a bit to learn from all this. 18 verses about what would seem to be the most pertinent point of the whole chapter, which is Sarah dies. And that only takes 2 verses. And the rest of it's basically legal affairs of a land. You know, the exchange of buying land. Negotiations for buying a burial plot and buying land, which on the surface seems pretty boring, really. In verse 1, if you look back in chapter 23, verse 1, I'm sorry, not verse 1, verse 4, Abraham declares himself to be both a stranger and a sojourner. He says, I'm a stranger and a sojourner with you. And that in the land of Canaan. The land of Canaan is that which God had promised to give to Abraham. So by the purchase of the land, he is no longer a sojourner. He may be a stranger because of his faith, but he has declared his faith in the promise of God. If you look at chapter 17, verses 7 and 8, remember God enlarges his promise and says, I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee in their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. It doesn't say that Abraham was going to be a sojourner all his life, only a stranger. You know, we're strangers in this world simply because of who we are, because of what we believe. But it doesn't mean that we have to be sojourners. We can own property. We can have a stake. We can stake a claim. We can have skin in the game. And that is exactly what Abraham determined that he needed to do. And by faith, that's exactly what he did. He weighed the promise of either going back to her, that which he came from, or the promise of God, and declared to himself, the promise of God is better than the promise of man. If you look at Hebrews chapter 11, starting in verse 13, the author of Hebrews, after going through a laundry list of people, said, these all died in faith, not having received the promises. And the fact of the matter is, Abraham never possessed all the land of Canaan. His only possession in the land of Canaan was that field. Even though God said, to you and to your seed, I will give all this land. The only thing Abraham ever owned was that field. But, as the author of Hebrews says, all these died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them far off. So it's possible to see the promise of God still distant out there and stake a claim on something you're not quite to yet. It says, having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. Well, that's exactly what Abraham was doing. He could have gone back to that which he came from. But rather, he was seeking what God had promised to him. He sought a country. And truly, verse 15, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. And Abraham did. There was numerous times throughout his life when he could have just thrown in the towel and gone back. There was numerous times, and as you saw, right before he had to make a decision: am I going to buy property or not? He had to make the decision: go back or stay. But as Hebrews says in verse 16, now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He hath prepared for them a city. So, you know, at some point in everybody's Christian life, they reach a crossroads where they can either turn back from where they're going and leave the Lord behind and say, this isn't for me. And I don't think the promise is as advertised. And go back to where they came from. Or they can stake a claim and they can purchase a possession and continue on in the direction of God, maybe never receiving the full promises in their lifetime, but being fully persuaded, as Paul says, that those promises are true and that God is able to do that which He has promised to do. So by his purchase of land, Abraham does a couple of things. First of all, not only did he deepen his faith in God, he also took a greater role in the world. From someone who pays property tax. If you don't pay property tax, you ought to buy some property, and you'll learn all about it. When you own property, you take a stake in that part of the world which you live in. You're governed by the government that rules over that particular part of the world. Here in the United States, of course, you have you have townships and counties and cities and states and then you have the federal government. So there's layer upon layer of government that you answer to in the world. And so and no matter where you go, it's always like that. Well, Abraham also took a stake in the world when he purchased that little plot of land. Realized that he then became a citizen not only his citizenship might have been in heaven, his eternal citizenship might have been in heaven, but because he was no longer a sojourner, he owned land. He was responsible for that land. He buried his wife there. He was going to be buried there one day. His grandson Jacob was buried there. I mean, that was the family burial plot. But it carries with it obligation. And with obligation also, there's the rule of kings and authorities and all, you know, that type of government over you, because you're a citizen of the world and a landowner. So, you know, he didn't only deepen his faith in God, he took a greater role in the world as well. Is that a bad thing? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Yeah, but it's worth a lot now that I feel it. Yeah, exactly. But you know, taking a role in the world is not an anti-Christian thing to do. It is a very, the opposite, is a very Christian thing to do. Look at 1 Peter chapter 2, starting in verse 11, and see what Peter has to say about our role in the world. It says, "Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles." You know, you think about Abraham, who wasn't all that honest among the Gentiles, but then learned to be honest in his dealings with those who were not worshippers of God. Well, we need to also be honest in our dealings with those, whether they be our brothers in Christ or whether they be unbelievers. Always having our conversation honest among all people, all men. That, Peter says, whereas they speak against you as evildoers, that may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. You know, whatever we do it for the glory of God. Never shaming God, never shaming the Lord or ourselves by dishonest works. Peter says to submit yourself to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors, as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of them that do well. For it is the will of God that with well doing ye may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free, and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. So you take a role in the world, just as Abraham did. You are citizens of heaven, but also you have worldly involvement in the very same way. You can't just divorce yourself from your obligations of the world and from doing those things in the world. You know, you can't just take your head out of the world, as many Christians seem to want to do. Paul says in Romans 13, 1 through 7, that while our inheritance is in heaven, an eternal inheritance, no doubt about it is. We're going to leave this body behind down here, and we're not taking anything with us. But while we're here, we must submit ourselves to worldly authorities, obey laws, pay taxes, all those things. So we'll end tonight with just four small things, just points to think about, and then we'll end for the evening. The first being that the tomb, which was purchased by Abraham, is in fact a testament to his faith. It was for centuries, it stood there as a testament to his faith. in likewise the empty tomb of our Lord Jesus Christ is the promise that the grave is not our final resting place. Where we invest our money, nothing is said as to whether the price that Abraham paid for the field, whether it was high, low, fair, or unfair, the Bible is silent. And frankly, it doesn't matter. But Abraham paid for the land. He thought it necessary to invest in the promise of God. And where we invest our money says quite a bit about where we plan to spend our future. The covenant of God, number three, should be the basis for our day-to-day actions and decisions. God has made promises to us, and we should live our lives according to those promises, just as Abraham did. He made decisions according to the promises of God, and all that he did was influenced by the promises of God. And our understanding of how the world works, what goes on in the world, how we live our lives, the decisions that we make, all those things should be in the light of God's promises. And lastly, the death and the burial of a loved one, while it can be particularly grievous, it can be a hard time and one to weep, it can also be a great opportunity to publicly express our faith to others. As Abraham publicly expressed his faith in the covenant promises of God by purchasing the burial sepulcher and the field in the land of Canaan, the land which God had made promise to Abraham that he would inherit, we too can also walk amongst our grieving and weeping, be joyful when we know that those who have departed are going to be raised from the dead, and we're going to meet them again in the presence of the Lord. So, good reason to publicly express our faith to others, even when others pass.